This is an ABC podcast.
Afternoon, welcome to The World Today. I'm Thomas O'Reilly. This Monday, a royal commission criticises Australia for lagging behind comparable nations when it comes to monitoring well-being in aged care. And the US Food and Drug Administration gives a cautious seal of approval to an experimental COVID treatment. But how strong is the evidence it works? We'll take a look. But first today, a New Zealand court has heard a chilling and graphic account of the Christchurch mosque killings at the start of a marathon sentencing hearing for the Australian who carried out the attacks. The court heard that the defendant was motivated by an intention to kill as many what he called invaders as possible and had intended to burn the mosques he targeted to the ground. Survivors and family members of those killed have also begun reading victim impact statements, some of them directly addressing the defendant. Barbara Miller has been following proceedings on a live link from the court. She joins me now. There is a warning. Her reporting contains some distressing content. Barb, let's start with the planning and preparation for these attacks. What has the court been told?
The court was told, Tom, and this was in the reading of the summary of facts, this is the first time we've ever heard this information publicly, that in 2017, the defendant, Brenton Tarrant, originally from New South Wales, obtained a gun license in New Zealand. He then set about essentially amassing weapons and adapting them to make them more deadly. And the court heard about his motivation for this attack that he began to hatch a plan for, we heard. And this was because he considered people who are Muslim or non-European as invaders. He wanted not only to instill fear into, in his words, the invaders, but to kill them. And he thought that he could help in that quest. We heard also about a reconnaissance mission to his primary target, Al-Nur Mosque, which included flying a drone over it. And in some very distressing content, when he was picked up eventually on his way to what was a third mosque, he expressed regret to police that he hadn't been able to kill more worshippers.
As you say, this is distressing content. What do we hear about the crimes themselves?
I think what for me was just really distressing was the methodical way in which it was described that he'd carried out these crimes. Not only did he fire at people, he then went up to people lying on the ground, many of them in prone position or huddled together, and targeted them again. This included, for example, a young boy, a three-year-old, the youngest of the 51 victims, who at the time where he was taken aim at was clinging to his father's leg. He also drove over one woman. So some really quite graphic details there. Also, though, a couple of reports of bravery. For example, one worshipper, Naeem Rashid, lunged at the gunman. He got within a metre of him, but was then gunned down himself. We were told, though, that his actions did allow some people to escape. And the same, this was at Al-Nur Mosque, at Linwood Mosque. Again, a couple of acts of bravery, someone screaming at him, running towards him. And then once he'd abandoned a weapon, a man picked that up and threw it at the fleeing car. He managed to shatter a window there.
Now, the families of those killed as well as those injured have begun reading victim impact statements. Dozens will do so. No doubt very powerful scenes.
Indeed, and they began very powerfully with the imam at Al-Nur Mosque, Jamal Fuda. He had quite a few things to say directly to the defendant. He said, "You were misguided and misled, and we are a peaceful and loving community who did not deserve your evil actions." Now, Jamal Fuda also addressed the gunman's family in Australia, and he said that he offered them respect because they are suffering as we are, they said. He said, "Australia is our neighbour and we are all one against hate and racism." We heard from some more victims and survivors. Again, that message of strength coming through. One woman, the mother of a victim, telling the defendant, "You transgressed and you thought you can break us," she said, "but you failed miserably." And this afternoon's session, Tom, set to contain more of those victim impact statements.
Okay, thanks, Barb. Reporter Barbara Miller there. It's been a torrid morning for the financial services giant AMP, which has been rocked by the resignation of Chairman David Murray over the company's handling of sexual harassment complaints against a top executive. In addition to Mr. Murray, the former Treasury Secretary John Fraser will leave the AMP board after a revolt by major shareholders who are unhappy about the scandal and the ongoing reputational damage being inflicted on the company. Our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan, is covering the resignations. He joined me earlier. Afternoon, Pete. So AMP was already badly damaged by allegations from the Banking Royal Commission, as you covered extensively. What do these resignations say about cultural change there now?
Well, good afternoon, Tom. David Murray is a former chairman of the Future Fund, a former chief executive of the Commonwealth Bank, and he was installed as the go-to guy back in 2018 to fix AMP's cultural problems when the Banking Royal Commission forced the resignation of then-chairman Catherine Brenner and some other AMP directors and executives. Now, having been brought in to restore AMP's battered reputation, Mr. Murray was then confronted with a lot of internal unhappiness at AMP and the fury of some big shareholders when Bo Pahari was appointed chief executive of AMP Capital in July. Now, Mr. Pahari had been the subject of sexual harassment complaints in the past, and he'd been penalised as a result, but his elevation became the subject of a scandal about the way AMP handles complaints in relation to women. Now, Mr. Murray didn't return calls this morning, but in a statement, he conceded the view of some shareholders that Mr. Pahari's appointment was, quote, not appropriate, and that his decision to quit as chairman reflected his accountability. AMP Director Deborah Hazelton is now AMP's new chairman. Now, Mr. Pahari is not leaving AMP. He's stepping down as AMP Capital Chief Executive to his previous level as an executive. Banking analyst Brett Lemessurier told me David Murray's decision to quit underscores the cultural issues that remain at AMP.
David Murray departing is unfortunate because he had a very important role in transforming Commonwealth Bank, and so he may well have been an important catalyst in the improvement that was needed at AMP, but that's not to be anymore. Now, obviously, the problems at AMP have been going on for some time and they seem to be fairly deep-rooted. So it's going to take a significant effort on the part of the new chair to improve the situation, also on the part of the current CEO.
Mr. Pahari remains in the company, though, one step down. How long can he survive?
Well, he's obviously going to survive to the end of the day, but whether he survives another year or two, I don't know. Obviously, the return to his previous role is going to put him in a much more chastened position. I'm sure he's learnt many lessons out of this.
And how do you sum up the reputational damage for AMP?
Oh, significant. It's another blow. Responsible behaviour in the workplace and the promotion of women and the appropriate treatment of women on an equal standing is something that AMP clearly seems to have struggled with across the board, and it needs very significant improvement.
Shaw and Partners banking analyst Brett Lemessurier there, and Peter Ryan's with me. Peter, how have investors reacted to Mr. Murray's resignation?
Tom, AMP shares were up more than 1% in late morning trade to $1.44. This time 5 years ago, they were almost $6 a share. So that demonstrates how far AMP has fallen and the tough road back.
Peter Ryan there. Well, Parliament's back after an extra long coronavirus-enforced winter break. Legislation will be introduced to extend wage subsidies and extra support for the unemployed, though at less generous rates. But a brewing political scandal inside the Victorian branch of the Liberal Party is threatening to distract attention from the agenda and has already seen the resignation of a factional heavyweight. Here's our political reporter, Tom Iggledon.
Same state, different party. After allegations of industrial-scale branch stacking inside Labor earlier this year, now the Liberal Party's feeling the heat. Assistant Treasurer Michael Sukkar and his Victorian Right factional ally and former Senior Minister Kevin Andrews are embroiled. There's no suggestion they were directly involved, But the Nine newspapers and the 60 Minutes program have revealed allegations their offices were used to provide taxpayer-funded positions for officers who were doing party political work. At the centre of allegations is Victorian factional heavyweight Marcus Bastion, who stands accused of stacking Liberal Party branches with members with little or no affiliation with the party. Mr. Bastion's now resigned from the party, saying in a statement that he rejects any allegations of branch stacking, but he's now stepping away so that he can focus on his business. Mr. Sukar and Mr. Andrews both deny any wrongdoing and have referred the matter to the Department of Finance, which oversees the use of taxpayer-funded jobs. Treasurer Josh Frydenberg is the most senior member of the government to hail from the Victorian branch of the party, and he told Sky News this morning that there's no case for Mr. Sukar to step down as Assistant Treasurer.
Many Liberals will be shocked and very concerned by the behaviour and by the language that was used. And I've spoken since that program with the president of the Victorian division, with the state director in Victoria, as well as with the opposition leader in Victoria, and the Liberal Party will be dealing with those matters internally.
But Labor says Michael Sukar should be gone, and gone today. Opposition leader Anthony Albanese told RN Breakfast's Fran Kelly that in making that call, he's merely applying the same logic that Prime Minister Scott Morrison used when Labor found itself confronting branch stacking allegations.
Scott Morrison said this was a test for me. Once again, a bit like aged care, he's saying it's not his responsibility. It's a matter for the organisational wing. Well, someone needs to tell Scott Morrison that he's actually in charge of the Liberal Party, that this is a scandal, that his assistant treasurer is in it up to his neck, in his own words here, and that his position is untenable.
The political fracas comes amid some sobering new jobs numbers from Treasury about the impact of the spike in coronavirus cases in Victoria. They show an economic recovery in June, with almost 700,000 Australians getting back to work and the effective unemployment rate dropping from almost 15% to a tick under 10%. But the Victorian lockdown in July has reversed those gains. Treasury now expects 450,000 jobs to be lost again as a result of that lockdown, and effective unemployment to rocket back up to more than 13% over coming months. The grim outlook comes as Parliament prepares to debate legislation to be introduced this week that would extend the JobKeeper wage subsidy and the JobSeeker special coronavirus payment for the unemployed past next month's expiry date, but at lower rates. Josh Frydenberg is sticking to that plan despite today's new figures.
Well, it's a transition downwards over time, but we've extended the program, which was initially for 6 months, and we've extended it for 12 months. So we'll go out to the end of March. And importantly, this is going to be significantly supporting many businesses in sectors that continue to do it tough.
But Labor says JobKeeper and JobSeeker, which it supported, have been critical in dealing with coronavirus, and Anthony Albanese is calling on the government to rethink its decision to wind them back.
Tom Eagledon. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks very much for your company. To the latest on the pandemic now, New South Wales has recorded 3 new cases today, 2 in hotel quarantine. And Victoria is reporting 116. That's the lowest daily tally since early July, but another 15 people have died. Samantha Donovan joins me now from Melbourne with the latest. Afternoon, Sam. It looks like the case numbers are definitely on that downward trend. What more can you tell us about today's numbers?
Yes, it's great to see the daily cases continuing to come down, Tom. 116 is the lowest daily tally, I believe, since the 5th of July. So certainly that's giving Victorians some hope that we're heading in the right direction. But that news is tempered by the death toll. Very sadly, another 15 people have died in the last day. They were all nursing home residents, and they ranged in age from their 80s through to one lady who was over 100. So terrible news for the family and friends of those people, and their deaths bring the total Victorian death toll to 430. The Premier, Daniel Andrews, says there are now 1,568 active virus cases in aged care in Victoria, and from all parts of the community in terms of people in hospital, there are 629 patients, 31 of them are in intensive care, and 17 of those patients are on ventilators.
And Sam, the Premier Premier has announced the state of emergency is to be extended. Now, what does that mean for the lives of Victorians?
Yes, he's drafting legislation in the hope that he can extend the state of emergency for another 12 months. It's currently due to expire on September the 13th. Now, this is separate to the state of disaster. The state of emergency doesn't relate to the stage 3 and 4 restrictions that we're living under at the moment in Victoria, so people shouldn't panic and think the restrictions are going to last that long. We certainly hope not. A state of emergency, though, does allow the government to make rules about things like COVID safe plans in workplaces, isolating at home if you're sick, the wearing of face masks. Now, there's no guarantee that the opposition and the crossbenchers will support this proposal to change the law, but Mr. Andrews says he'll be speaking to them and encouraging them to support the bill. He argues that after the second wave has passed, and particularly if we don't get a vaccine, the government needs to be able to make these rules to keep people safe.
Okay, Samantha Donovan in Melbourne there, thank you. The outbreak has obviously had very tragic consequences in the aged care sector, and today the Royal Commission into Aged Care has slammed Australia's lack of monitoring in the homes as unacceptable. The Commission has released research showing that Australia lags behind in measuring indicators like falls and fractures. And at the same time, the Federal Aged Care Minister has released a report into the first outbreak of COVID-19 at an aged care facility. That was Newmarch House in Sydney, where 19 residents died. Patricia Sparrow is the Chief Executive of Aged and Community Services Australia, which represents not-for-profit aged care providers. She spoke to me a short time ago. Patricia Sparrow, the review has pinpointed a number of issues that led to the Newmarch House situation. One of them is seemingly down to confusion. The Anglicare Board was unfamiliar with the agencies involved and the hierarchy of decision making. Now, is that confusion and lack of clarity an issue that goes beyond Newmarch House?
Look, I think that we have got better at ensuring who is actually in control of the situation. And in nearly most instances, it's the aged care provider. But there are some decisions that are made, for example, sending people to hospital or not, that's actually made by the state. So I think it's got clearer. But I think with that many people in, you have to make sure that you're constantly on top of it and that at each outbreak, it's very clear who's doing what.
Linked to that is the issue of communication, you know, speaking to the families involved in a timely and sensitive manner. Now, according to the report, the system was really stretched to the limit when it came to those efforts to deliver that crucial information. How do you solve that? Does it come down to more resources or training, or was this simply an unprecedented situation?
I think there are different strategies coming to light now about how you can make your communications better, including actually reaching out to families before this happens, utilising staff, some of them who potentially may be isolating at home but aren't sick, actually using sort of capacity and resources like that to make sure that families are up to date and are getting good and accurate information, because the stress on those families is terrible. And what we have to do and what we want to do as providers is to make sure we're giving them timely and accurate information.
Now, the hospital and the home program was discussed. It basically means that medical staff would come to Newmarch to deliver care rather than sending the patients to hospital. Now, I'm asking you this obviously with the benefit of hindsight, but was that the right approach, or should elderly patients, even with minor symptoms, have been sent straight to hospital?
We have a really strong position on that. Our position is that the first cases of people who are diagnosed with COVID should go to hospital. We think that gives them the very best treatment that they can have. But we also think what it does is it helps us to try and contain the spread within a facility where we may have another 100 people living. So we've got to try and stop that spread. But also then if we do need to set up hospital in the home because other people become infected, it crucially gives us time to do that and to work with the public health unit to make sure that everything's in place and it can be done safely.
The Newmarch review is not the only report that's been released today. We've had one from the Aged Care Royal Commission as well, and it says that unlike other developed countries, Australia has no regime in place for monitoring aged care quality. So no monitoring of indicators like falls and fractures, hospital readmissions, hospitalisation for delirium, premature mortality. And a recommendation to have this was first made by the Productivity Commission back in 2011. I mean, why has so much time passed without a regime like this being established?
So, look, I think there was work done on the Productivity Commission report, and I think the report highlights that there are three indicators, which I agree is not a lot of indicators. I think the most interesting thing in the report that the Royal Commission's released today, and something that we have been drawing attention to, is there is a lot of information collected that nothing really happens with at the moment. And the report on quality indicators says there's a lot of information that's already sitting there that could be used.
Why isn't it being used?
It's a good question. It's often reported to, you know, various bodies, not pulled together and not used. So I actually think it's really important at the back of this report, which I'll be reading in detail later, to say if there is information there that we can use, and as long as it's information that's going to be meaningful for families and tell them something and meaningful for providers to help them improve their practice, we should absolutely be moving on that swiftly.
Okay, Patricia Sparrow, thanks very much for speaking to The World today.
Thank you.
That's the Chief Executive of Aged and Community Services Australia, Patricia Sparrow. Heading overseas now, and just yesterday, Donald Trump was suggesting America's Food and Drug Administration was part of a deep state conspiracy to kill off his re-election hopes by delaying coronavirus treatments. Well, today he's applauding the FDA's decision to grant emergency authorization to expand the use of experimental plasma therapy. Nick Grimm has been taking a look.
Today I'm pleased to make a truly historic announcement in our battle against the China virus that will save countless lives.
Like any politician facing re-election, Donald Trump loves a good announcement. And today's emergency authorization for the use of blood plasma therapy on COVID patients, an opportunity not to be missed by the US president, coming as it has on the eve of the Republican convention.
The FDA has issued an emergency use authorization, and that's such a powerful term, emergency use authorization for a treatment known as convalescent plasma.
Injecting blood plasma into COVID patients from those who've recovered from the infection, certainly a more promising alternative to other suggestions from the serving president, who not so long ago left health officials somewhat faint-headed with his proposal that people should be given shots of disinfectant. Today, Donald Trump's health secretary, Alex Azar, joined him to tout the benefits of plasma therapy.
We dream in drug development of something like a 35% mortality reduction. This is a major advance in the treatment of patients. This is a major advance.
It should be noted that America's safety watchdog, the Food and Drug Administration, has given the therapy a cautious seal of, well, non-approval. Remembering perhaps what happened with another of President Trump's favoured treatments, the drug hydroxychloroquine, which later had its authorisation withdrawn when new evidence suggested it might not live up to promises about its effectiveness and safety. FDA Chief Stephen Hahn explaining the distinction between approval and authorisation.
Under our legal authority for emergency use authorization, this is not the same as an approval, but it's an authorization and allows us to expand the access to this.
But it must be stressed that there are big hopes that plasma therapy can prove to be a game changer in the treatment of COVID. Here in Australia, clinical trials are also underway, and those who've recovered from the illness are being encouraged to donate their blood so that it can potentially help others who find themselves in the same position.
So basically, we're trying to boost someone's immune response prior to their own immune system having generated sufficient antibodies.
Associate Professor Stephen Tong is an infectious diseases physician at Royal Melbourne Hospital and a clinical researcher with the Doherty Institute.
I guess my concerns relate to the fact that it's probably an expensive therapy. This requires quite large-scale infrastructure where donors are required to go to, you know, Lifeblood or the blood bank to provide blood. It then needs to be screened appropriately through the usual blood product systems. Whenever you use something which potentially has some risk and is expensive, you want to know that it actually works and it actually makes a difference to the patients and reduces mortality ideally. And we just don't have that data at this stage. It also makes it harder, particularly in the United States, for the appropriate clinical trials to be run. If the United States president says that, you know, this is a great drug, everyone should get it, then of course it makes it much harder for patients to agree to be randomized to either receive the plasma or not.
So by putting his stamp of authority on the therapy, so to speak, he's undermined the ability to conduct adequate clinical trials.
That's correct. And, you know, we're hearing from investigators in the United States now that they have these concerns and that it's going to make it much, much harder to conduct the clinical trial because patients won't be willing to be randomized to a placebo.
In other words, they'll want the real thing.
Correct. Even though we don't know if it works for sure.
Infectious Diseases Physician Associate Professor Stephen Tong and Nick Grimm with that report. That's all from the World Today team for this Monday. Thanks very much for your company. Hope you can join us at the same time tomorrow. I'm Thomas Ariti. Stay safe and have a lovely afternoon.
Was looking for Nicola Gobbo, the woman who became known as Lawyer X.
The woman at the centre of Victoria's biggest legal scandal.
Since going into hiding, the only interview she's done is with the ABC. And now we can tell her full story.
People were going to be murdered.
She was working both sides of the fence.
I will make a point of holding those who did this to account.
The Informer, a gripping new season of the hit podcast Trace. Hear it on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.